her that for all that she'd built a life in Vinyatsa City, there was a different one waiting for her back in Hostral. Safi needed Isolde right now. She relied on Isolde to keep her mind focused and clear. Acting and running and fighting, those were the only things Safi did well. Her fingers itched for the door. Her toes curled in anticipation as she reached with aching slowness for the latch.
"Don't touch that," Habim intoned. "What would you do anyway, Safi? Run away?"
"Find Isolde," she said quietly, her fingers still hovering. "And then run away."
"Which would allow the Blood Witch to find you," he retorted. "As long as you stay with your uncle, you'll be safe."
"Because he did such a good job protecting my parents." The words snarled out before Safi could stop them. Yet where she'd expected a swift retaliation from Habim, she got only silence.
Then Astoni, "Hellbards protect their family, yes, but the Empire must come first. In that instance, 18 years ago, the Empire came first."
"Which is why Emperor Henrik dishonorably discharged him, is it? He gave Uncle Erend the shameful task of being my regent and nursemaid out of gratitude."
Habim didn't engage.
In fact, his expression didn't waver at all.
This was hardly the first time Safi had pressed Habim on her uncle's past, and it wasn't the first time she'd gotten cold silence either.
"You're going home, to Guildmaster Alex's," Habim said eventually, tipping back the edge of the curtain and squinting outside. "You should have gone to him in the first place. He can keep you safe from the Blood Witch."
"How was I supposed to know that?"
Safi finally withdrew her fingers from the latch and sat up to her full height.
"I thought I was doing the right thing by not bringing trouble to Alex's door."
"How very considerate of you. Next time, though, try trusting the men charged with your safety."
"Isolde keeps me safe, too," Safi said. "Yet notice that you've sent her away."
Again, Habim ignored Safi's bait. Instead, he dipped his chin to watch her from the tops of his eyes.
"Speaking of Isolde, she requests that you please not slit my throat. She also apologizes for leaving and asks that you not lose her book."
"Isolde apologized? That wasn't like Isolde.
At least not when this was so clearly Safi's fault."
Which meant there was a hidden message here.
It was a game the girls had played over the years. One Matthew had taught them.
"Say one thing, but mean another."
And it had been wildly fun during the more dull hours of Matthew's history lessons. It wasn't fun now.
"Don't slit Habim's throat."
That meant to wait. To do as Habim ordered. Fine. Safi would obey for now. But the book. She couldn't riddle out that part of the message.
"Isolde's and my things," Safi said slowly, "are in a sack at the harbor."
"I already grabbed it. The driver's holding it."
Another furtive glance behind the curtain before Habim pounded the roof. The carriage clattered to a stop, and Habim offered Safi an inflectionless,
"Stay out of trouble, please."
Then he swept through the door and melted into the cacophony of afternoon traffic. With her fists never feeling as if they were squeezed tightly enough, Safi stepped into the city. Horses' hooves, carriage wheels, and fancy boot heels drowned out her frustrated teeth grinding. Alex's home was a many-columned mansion surrounded by a jungle of roses and jasmine. Like all the Dalmari guildmasters, he lived in the wealthiest corner of the city, the Eastern Canal District. Safi had a bedroom inside, and the young, fair-haired Alex had always been kind to her. but this luxe, labyrinthine estate had never felt like home, not in the way that Isolde's attic room always had, not in the way the girls' new rooms were going to. For several long moments, Sophie stood at the iron gate and considered making a run for it. Her throat burned with a hunger for speed, but she knew she couldn't find Isolde, not without risking the Blood Witch. Gods below, everything was falling apart, and it was all Sophie's fault. Sophie had fallen for Chiseled Cheater's charms. Then Sophie had suggested the hold-up. It was always this way. Sophie would initiate something over her head, and someone else would clean up the mess. That someone had been Isolde for 6 years now. But how many messes would Sophie have to make before Isolde had had enough? One of these days, Isolde would give up on her like everyone else had. Sophie just prayed, desperately, violently prayed, that it wasn't today. It isn't, though, her logic pointed out. Or Isolde wouldn't have left a message with Habim or told you to find the book. Well, Sophie would only be able to puzzle through Isolde's coded message if she went inside Alex's mansion as ordered. So with her knuckles cracking against her thighs, she marched up to the gate and rang the bell. Despite the flowers and incense jars in the silk guildmaster's home, the smell wafting off the nearby canal always dominated Sophie's nose. There was no escaping it. And as Sophie gazed from the window of her second-story bedroom, she tapped her toes on the sky-blue rug, a frantic counterbeat to her heart. Fine silk gowns were draped on the large four-poster bed that she rarely slept in. This wasn't the first time Guildmaster Alex had crafted dresses for Sophie, although these were far finer than anything she'd ever received before. Footsteps clapped behind her. Matthew. Sophie knew that loping stride, and when she turned to her tutor, she found his thin, freckled face was a mask of hard lines, his red hair aglow in the afternoon light. Matthew and Habim could not have been more different, in looks or in personality, and of the two, Sophie had always preferred Matthew. Perhaps because she knew Matthew regarded her more highly than Habim ever had. They were kindred spirits, she and Matthew. More inclined to act than to think, to laugh than to frown. Even without his word witchery, Matthew was a master criminal, a con man of the highest caliber. Habim had taught Sophie to use her body as a weapon. Yet it was Matthew who'd taught her to use her mind. Her words. And though Sophie had never understood why Matthew insisted she learn his confidence skills, she'd always been too afraid to ask, just in case he then decided to stop. Like Habim, Matthew currently wore the gray and blue livery of the Hastrals. But unlike Habim, Matthew wasn't a servant for Sophie's uncle. Your things. Matthew flung a familiar bag onto the bed. And Sophie made no move to retrieve it, though she did glance at it, checking for the shape of Isolde's books. They were there, a blue corner poked from the top. My shop is destroyed. Matthew's lanky form closed in on Sophie, blocking her view of the book, or of anything but his green flashing eyes. A broken door, broken windows. What the hell flames possessed you to hold up a guildmaster? Sophie wet her lips. It was an accident. The wrong mark hit our trap. Ah, Matthew's shoulders relaxed. Then he suddenly stepped in close and gripped Sophie's chin, like he'd done 1,000 times over the past 6 years. He twisted her head left, right, looking for cuts or bruises or any sign that she might start to cry. But she was unharmed, and tears were far, far away. Matthew's hand fell. He rocked back a single step. I'm glad you're unhurt.
With that single phrase, Safi's breath whooshed out and she flung her arms around his neck.
I'm sorry, she murmured into his lapel.
A lapel with the wretched Hostral Mountain bat embroidered on it.
I'm so sorry about your shop.
At least you're alive and safe.
Safi pulled free, wishing Habim would see it that way too.
Your uncle needs you tonight, Matthew went on, striding to the bed.
He yanked one of the gowns off the coverlet, its pistachio silk shimmering in the afternoon sun.
Safi glared at the dress. It was, to her annoyance, quite beautiful, and exactly the sort of thing she'd choose for herself.
Does he need me or my witchery?
He needs you, Matthew said. There is a ball tonight to kick off the truce summit. Henrik has specifically requested your attendance.
Safi's gut flipped. But why? I'm not ready to be a full domna or lead the Hostral Lands.
It's not that,
Matthew interrupted, turning his attention back to the dress in his hand, then shaking his head dismissively and draping it on the bed once more.
You're not needed in that capacity.
True.
The fact is that we don't know why Henrik wants you here, but Aaron could hardly refuse.
Magic shivered over Safi's skin. False. Don't lie to me, she said quietly, lethally. Matthew didn't answer but hoisted up a second dress instead. This one thicker and in pale pink. Safi bared her teeth.
You can't send my thread sister away and not explain why, Matthew.
Matthew held Safi's gaze for several long breaths, for once seeming as unyielding as his heart thread. Then his posture loosened, and an apology slid into the line of his shoulders. He dropped the gown in a heap.
There are big wheels in motion, Safi. Wheels your uncle and many others have spent 20 years rolling into position. The truce ends in 8 months, and the great war will resume. We cannot let that happen.
Safi's head coiled back. This was not what she'd expected.
How could you or my uncle possibly affect the Great War?
You'll know soon enough, Matthew replied.
Now, get cleaned up and wear this gown tonight.
The faintest dusting of power coated Matthew's words, and as he held out a silvery white dress, the witch mark on the back of his hand, a hollow circle for ether, and a scripted W for word witchery, almost seemed to glow.
Safi's nostrils flared. She snatched away the filmy gown, the fabric slipping through her fingers like sea foam.
Don't waste your magic on me. Something about her truth witchery canceled out Matthew's persuasiveness. But all Matthew said in return was, as if he knew more than she could ever imagine. Then he twirled elegantly toward the door.
A maid will arrive shortly to help you with your bath. Don't forget behind the ears and under the fingernails.
Safi bit her thumb at Matthew's back, but the act of defiance felt empty, ashy. Her wrath from the carriage was already seeping out and oozing into the floorboards like the blackened oil of the cleaved man's blood.
Safi tossed the gown on the bed, and her eyes settled on the corner of the Carowin book. She would fix this mess she'd made. Once she understood Isolde's message, Safi would pick through her opponents, her uncle, the Blood Witch, the city guards, and she would estimate her terrain. Vinyatsa City, the Truce Summit Ball. Then Safi would fix this.
7. Isolde ducked into the street behind the wharf as ordered by Habim. Hunching deep beneath the scratchy hood, she wefted her way through horses and carts, merchants and guild lackeys,
and threads of every imaginable shade and strength. At last, she caught sight of a stamped wooden sign that declared, "The Hawthorne Canal." Isolde recognized it now. Safi had played tarot here a few months before. Yet unlike last night, she'd actually won. A splash of white beneath the sign caught Isolde's eyes, glaring and conspicuous against the smear of colors that was a Vinyatsa City thoroughfare. It was a Carowin monk with no threads. None. Isolde's insides iced over. She froze mid-step, watching the monk stride down the street, away from her. He was clearly on the hunt. Every few steps, he would pause, and the back of his hood would tilt as if he sniffed the air. It was his lack of threads, though, that kept Isolde immobile. She'd thought she'd simply missed the Blood Witch's threads in the wildness of the fight yesterday. But no. He still wore no threads. Which was impossible. Everyone had threads. End of story. "You want a rug?" asked a carpet salesman, pushing in close to Isolde, all sweat-stained robes and heavy breathing. "Mine are straight from Asmir. But I'll give you a good deal." Isolde flicked up a flat palm.
"Back away, or I will cut off your ears and feed them to the rats."
Normally, this threat served Isolde well. Normally, though, she was in the Northern Wharf District, where her Nomatsi skin went mostly ignored. And normally, she had Safi at her side to show teeth and look suitably terrifying. Today, Isolde had none of those things. And unlike Safi, who would have reacted instantly, who would have run at the first sight of the monk, Isolde only wasted more time evaluating her terrain. It was in that two-breath pause that the carpet vendor shoved in closer and squinted beneath her hood. His threads blazed into gray fear, black hate. "Matsi shit," he hissed, swiping fingers across his eyes. Then he lunged, voice lifting as he tore back Isolde's hood. "Get away, Matsi shit! Get away!" Isolde hardly needed that second command. She was finally doing what Safi would have done from the start. She got away. Or she tried to, but traffic was stopping to ogle her, to close in. Everywhere she turned or jerked, she met eyes locked on her face, her skin, her hair. She jolted back from threads of gray fear and steely violence. The commotion attracted the Carowin's attention. He stopped his forward trek, swiveled toward the rising shouts of the crowd, and looked directly at Isolde. Time stretched out and the crowd shrank back, blurring into a quilt of threads and sound. For a fraction of a heartbeat that felt like eternity, all Isolde saw were the young monk's eyes. Red eddied across the palest blue she'd ever seen, like blood melting through ice, like a heart thread twining through blue threads of understanding. Vaguely, Isolde wondered how she'd missed that flawless blue color at the holdup. As all of these thoughts careened through her brain at 1,000 leagues a second, she wondered if this monk would really hurt her like everyone feared. Then the monk's lips rippled back. He bared his teeth, and the pause in the world fractured. Time flooded forward, resumed its normal speed. And Isolde finally ran, bolting behind a gray horse. She chucked her elbow hard into its lower rump. It reared. The young woman on its back screamed, and with that burst of high-pitched vocals and the sudden, violent whinnying from the horse, the entire street surged out of the way. Orange, frantic threads flared around Isolde, but she barely registered them. She was already shoving and sprinting for an intersection one block back. There was a bridge over the nearest canal there. Maybe if she could cross the canal, she could lose the Blood Witch. Her feet thrashed through mud, hopped over beggars, skidded around carts. But then, halfway to the bridge, she glanced back and wished she hadn't. The Blood Witch was definitely pursuing, and he was definitely fast. The same people who'd been intent on slowing Isolde now cleared out of his path.
"Move!"
Isolde shrieked at a purist with his repent sign. He didn't move, so she clipped him on the shoulder. He and his sign went spinning like a windmill, but it worked in Isolde's favor, for even though she lost speed, even though she was forced to dive beneath a passing litter carried by four men, it looked as if she aimed left for the bridge, and she heard the purist bellowing to go after her across the canal. So she didn't go left as planned. Instead, she slung right on her heel and aimed straight back into traffic, praying the monk listened to the purist and went left, praying, desperately praying, that he couldn't smell her blood scent through these salamander fibers. She foisted her hood in place and hurtled onward. There was another intersection coming up, a thick flow of traffic east to west toward a second bridge. She'd have to barrel through, continue straight, or not. Just as she pelted behind a woodcutter's cart and popped around a cheesemonger's stall, she hit empty air. Isolde tossed her arms wide, teetering toward an unexpected canal of green, sludgy waters, almost as packed with people as the streets. Then a long, flat-hulled pram slid beneath Isolde, and in half a breath, she absorbed the scene below.
Shallow deck covered in nets. Fishermen gaping up at me.
Isolde stopped fighting her fall. Instead, she leaned into it. Air rushed against her. White lacy nets closed in fast. Then she was on the deck, knees bending, hands catching herself. Something sliced through her palm. A rusted hook, she realized, before she scrabbled upright. The pram listed wildly. The fisherman roared. But Isolde was already pumping toward the next passing boat, a low ferry with a frilly red awning.
"Look out!"
Isolde shouted, lunging high and grabbing hold of the balustrade. She hauled herself up as wide-eyed passengers reared back, blood smeared on the railing's pickets. Faintly, she hoped this burning slash didn't make her that much easier to follow for the Blood Witch. She scooted across the ferry in four bounds. It would seem everyone wanted Isolde off the boat as badly as she did. She topped the railing, sucked in a breath while another pram coasted by, this one covered in the day's mackerel. She jumped. Her feet squished, and suddenly she was sprawling on silver scales with a face full of gooey eyes. The fisherman shrieked at her, more displeased than surprised, and Isolde hefted herself up to find his black beard bearing down. She pushed past, elbowing him in the gut, right as they cruised by a low staircase clumped with pole fishermen. A rough jump later, and Isolde latched onto the flagstone stairs. None of the fishermen offered to help. They only shuddered back. One even stabbed at her with his fishing pole, his threads a terrified gray. Isolde grabbed the end of the pole. The man's threads blazed brighter, and he tried to yank the pole back, but proceeded to yank up Isolde instead.
"Thank you," she thought.
Straddling up the stairs, she glanced back once and saw blood streaked on the stones. Her palm was gushing a lot more than the distant pain warranted. She reached the street. Traffic swarmed past, and she scrambled for some strategy. All of her plans were falling through the hell gates. But surely Isolde could take a moment to think. She was crap at running pell-mell. It was why Sophie was the leader in these situations. Without time to strategize, Isolde always ran herself into corners. But as she stood there, slinking alongside the canal and clutching her bleeding hand in her cloak, she got the moment she needed.
"Wide road," she thought, a main artery from town, likely alongside this canal the whole way. Traffic organized in two directions, and a man leading a saddled brindle mare. No sweat darkening the mare's shoulders. If I take her, I can flee the city entirely and hide overnight with the tribe.
Though returning to the home she'd spent most of her life avoiding was hardly Isolde's ideal solution, the Medenzi settlement was the only place she knew of that wouldn't kick her out at first sight of her skin. It was also the only place she felt certain the Blood Witch, even if he hunted her by sight and by blood, couldn't follow. The lands around the settlement were riddled with traps that no non-Medenzi could navigate. So in a flurry of speed, Isolde shrugged off her cloak, tossed it over the man's head, and then vaulted into the mare's saddle, praying all the while that the mare's flattening ears were a sign she was ready to ride.
"I'm so sorry,"
she shouted as the man flailed beneath the salamander cloak.
"I'll send her back."
Then she dug in her heels and left the man behind. As the mare launched into a fast trot through traffic, Isolde flung her gaze across the canal and found the Blood Witch watching her. There were gaps in the boats now. He couldn't cross the water as she had. But he could smirk at her. And wave, too. A flicker of his right fingers, and then a tapping of his right palm. He knew her hand was bleeding. And he was telling her he could follow, that he would follow, and likely be smiling that terrifying smile all the way. Isolde tore her gaze from his face, forcing her attention ahead. As she pressed low onto the mare's back and kicked the horse even faster, she prayed that the Moon Mother, or Noden, or any other god that might be watching, would help her get out of this city alive. Merrick stared at the miniature Dalmati ship gliding over the chart of the Jadantsi Sea. It showed that the corresponding trade ship was just hauling wind from the Vinyatsa city harbors, and Merrick wanted to fling the cursed miniature out the window. The Janna's voice witch, Herman, sat at the head of the table. Though by no means common, voice witches were the most common ether witch. And since they could find and communicate with fellow voice witches over vast distances, every ship in the New Brevenin Royal Navy had one on board, including Vivia, with whom voice witch Herman was now connected. Herman's eyes glowed pink, a sign he was tapped into the voice witch threads, and afternoon light flickered over his wrinkled face. Distant voices, rattling carts and clopping hooves, drifted in through open windows. Merrick knew he should shut them, but it was too sticky and too hot without the breeze. Plus, the tallow in the lantern smoked and stank, an even fouler stench than the sewage on the Vinyatsa city canals. But Merrick thought it was worth saving money with smelly animal fat rather than paying heaps for smokeless fire witch lanterns. And, of course, that was a point upon which he and Vivia disagreed. One of many.
"I don't think you understand, Mary."
Though Herman spoke with his own gravelly voice, he spoke in Vivia's exact style, all drawled words and condescending emphasis.
"The foxes strike instant fear in foreign navies. Hoisting that flag now will give us a strong advantage when the Great War resumes. Except,"
Merrick said with no inflection,
"we're here to negotiate peace. And though I agree fox flags were once effective for intimidation, that was centuries ago, before the empires had navies to crush ours."
It seemed so gallant on the surface, attacking trade ships to feed the poor. And tales of the old fox navies were still favorites back home. But Merrick knew better. Stealing from the more fortunate was still stealing, and promising to avoid violence was easier than actually refraining.
"I have one more meeting,"
Merrick insisted.
with the Gold Guild. Which will fail, as all your other meetings have. I thought you wanted to feed your people, Mary.
Sparks ignited in his chest.
Never, he growled, question my desire to feed New Brevna. You claim you want it, yet when I give you a way to gather food, a way to teach the empires a lesson, you don't jump at the chance. Because what you propose is piracy.
Merrick found it hard to look at Herman, as the voice which continued to croon Vivia's words.
What I propose is evening the odds. And may I remind you, Mary, that unlike you, I've attended summit meetings before. I've seen how the empires crush us beneath their heels. This ether-witched miniature is a means of fighting back. All you have to do is tell me when the trade ship reaches the New Brevnan coast, and then I'll do all the dirty work. All the killing, you mean.
It took every piece of Merrick's fragile self-control not to shout that at Vivia. But there was no point. Not when two voice witches and 100 leagues stood between them. He rolled his shoulders once. Twice.
What, he finally continued, does father say about this? Nothing.
Herman drawled that word exactly as Vivia would.
Father is on the verge of death, and he stays as silent as when you left. Why, he roused himself to name you as envoy and admiral, I'll never understand. Yet he seems to be working in our favor, for we have an opportunity here, Mary. One that fits very neatly into your strategy for an empire of your own, you mean.
A pause.
Justice must be served, little brother.
An edge coated Vivia's words now.
Or have you forgotten what the empires did to our home? The Great War ended for them, but not for us. The least we can do is pay back the empires in kind, starting with a bit of noble piracy.
At those words, the heat in Merrick's chest lanced outward, coiled into his fists. Were he with Vivia, he would let this storm loose. After all, she had the same rage simmering in her veins. When Merrick was a boy, his father had been certain that Merrick was a powerful witch like his sister, that Merrick's tantrums had been manifestations of a great power within. So, at 7 years old, King Seraphin had forced Merrick into the witchery examination. Yet Merrick's tantrums hadn't been a sign of power at all. Merrick had barely been deemed strong enough for a witch mark, and King Seraphin had barely been able to hide his disgust in front of the examination board. That same morning, on the carriage ride back to the royal palace, and with Merrick's new diamond tattoo burning on the back of his hand, Merrick had learned in sharp, unyielding detail how deep his father's distaste ran. How a weak prince served no purpose to his family. Merrick would be joining his aunt, the Nihar outcast, on the family lands in the southwest.
You forget,
Herman said, still articulating Vivia.
Who will lead when father dies? You may have authority right now, but you are only a temporary admiral. I will be queen and admiral when the watery sleep finally claims father. I know what you will be,
Merrick said softly, his anger falling back in the face of cold fear. Vivia as queen. Vivia as admiral. Vivia sending New Brevnans like lambs to the slaughter. The farmers and the soldiers, the merchants and the miners, the shepherds and the bakers. They would die on Kartoran swords or in Marstaki flames. All while Vivia watched on. And Merrick's one solution, rebuilding trade and proving to Vivia that there were peaceful ways to keep New Brevnans fed. That plan had failed. The worst of it, though, was that even if he refused to help Vivia in this piracy endeavor, Merrick knew she would find another way. Somehow she would hoist the fox flag, and somehow she would condemn all of their homeland to Noden's hell. In the momentary pause, while Merrick struggled for some solution out of this nightmare, a knock sounded at the cabin door. Ryber, the ship's girl and Cullen's heartthread, poked her head in.
"Admiral, I'm sorry to interrupt, sir, but it's urgent. There's a man here to see you. He says his name is Von..."
Her dark face scrunched up.
"Von Hastrel. That was it. From Kartora. And he wants to discuss possible trade with you."
Merrick felt his jaw drop. Trade? With Kartora? It seemed impossible. Yet Ryber's earnest expression wasn't changing. Noden himself was interfering on Merrick's behalf, and he did so right when Merrick needed it most. Merrick wouldn't ignore a gift like that, so he rounded back to Herman.
"Vivia," he barked, "I'll help you, but on one condition." "I'm listening." "If I can negotiate a single line of trade for New Brevna, then you'll stop your piracy. Immediately."
A pause. Then a slow,
"Perhaps, Mary. If you do somehow establish trade, I'll consider lowering the fox flag. Now tell me, where is the Dalmati miniature right now?"
Merrick couldn't keep from smiling. A sly thing, as he glanced at the map. The miniature was just leaving the marshy edge of the Vinyatsa City Bay.
"It hasn't set sail," he declared,
something buoyant and hopeful rising in his chest.
"But I'll inform you the instant that it does." "Herman!"
Merrick clapped his hands on the voice switch's shoulder. The old sailor flinched.
"You can end the call now. And Ryber?"
Merrick flung his gaze at the door, smiling all the wider.
"Bring in this Von Hastrel man right away."
After washing, Safi followed an unfamiliar coffee-haired maid back to her room, where the woman dressed her in the silvery white gown that Matthew had chosen. Then the maid coaxed Safi's hair into a series of hanging curls that draped and bounced and glistened in the sunset. It was strange being dressed and doted upon. Safi hadn't experienced it in over 7 years. Uncle Aaron could never afford more than a handful of servants on the Hastrel estate, so the only time a maid had served Safi had been during the annual trips to Praga. Uncle Aaron might have been a disgraced hellbard, stripped of rank for only the gods knew why, and then appointed as a temporary dome until Safi was deemed fit to take over. But he still paid his tithes exactly as Henrik demanded. Every year, Aaron and Safi had gone to the Kartoran capital to hand over their meager funds and swear fealty to Emperor Henrik. And every year, it had been awful. Safi had always been taller than the boys, always stronger, while the other girls had always whispered about Safi's sloshed uncle and snickered at her ancient gowns. Yet it wasn't the shame that made the trips miserable. It was the fear. Fear of the hellbards. Fear that they would see Safi for the heretic she was. For the truth witch she was. In fact, were it not for Prince Leopold, or Polly, as Safi had always called him, taking her under his wing each time she visited. She felt certain the Hellbards would have caught her by now. It was the job of the Hellbard Brigade, after all, to sniff out unmarked heretics. And by order of the Crown, they were allowed to behead those heretics if they seemed dangerous or unwilling to cooperate.
Polly will probably be there tonight, Safi thought,
as she scrutinized herself in a narrow mirror beside the bed. It had been 8 years since she'd last snuck off with him to explore the sprawling Imperial Library. She couldn't imagine how his long pale lashes and flopping golden curls would translate into a 21-year-old man. Safi certainly looked different, and this pale gown accentuated it. The tight bodice emphasized the strength of her waist and abdomen. The fitted long sleeves showed off her corded arms. The tight bodice emphasized what few curves she possessed, and the flowing skirts softened her hips into a feminine roundness. The dangling braids brought out the curves of her jaw, the brightness of her eyes. Guildmaster Alex and his staff had truly outdone themselves this time. Once the maid had left, after laying a stunning white cape across the bed, Safi darted for her satchel and yanked out Isolt's Carowin book. Then she strode to the window, where the canals glowed like flames beneath a setting sun. Gauzy pink light filtered across the book's blue cover, and when Safi creaked it back, the pages whispered open to page 37. A bronze-winged lion glimmered up at her, marking the last page Isolt had been reading. Safi quickly scanned the text, a listing of Carowin monk divisions. The bedroom door burst wide. Safi had just enough time to stuff the book back into the satchel before her uncle marched into the room. Dom Aaron von Hastrel was a tall man, muscled and hard-boned like Safi. Yet unlike Safi, his wheat hair blended into silvery gray, and he wore purple bags beneath bloodshot eyes. For all that he'd been a soldier, he was nothing but a drunk now. Aaron stopped several paces away and scrubbed at the top of his head. It left his hair at all angles.
"By the 12," he drawled. "Why are you so pale? You look like the void got you."
Aaron lifted his chin, and Safi noticed just the slightest wavering in his posture.
"You must be nervous about the ball tonight."
"As are you," she said. "Why else would you be this drunk before dinner?"
Aaron's lips eased into a smile, a surprisingly alert smile.
"There's the niece I remember."
He crossed to the window, fixed his gaze outside, and set to toying with a thin gold necklace he always wore. Safi bit her lip, hating that, as usual, a hole was opening in her chest at the sight of Uncle Aaron. Though her blood ran with the same hostile blue as his, she and her uncle were strangers. And when Aaron was drunk, which he was more often than he was not, then Safi's witchery sensed nothing. No truth, no lies, no reaction whatsoever. As if whatever person he might be was washed away once the wine started flowing. There had been, and always would be, a wall of stone and silence between them. Leveling her shoulders, Safi strode to Aaron's side.
"So why am I here, Uncle? Matthew said you plan to interfere with the Great War. How exactly do you intend to do that?"
A gruff laugh from Aaron.
"So, Matthew let that slip, did he?"
"Do you need to use my witchery?" Safi pressed. "Is that what this is about? Some drunken scheme to reclaim your Hellbard honor?"
"No."
The word snapped out. Strong. Unyielding.
"This is not a drunken scheme, Safiya. Far from it."
Aaron splayed his hands on the glass, and the old burn scars on his fingers and knuckles stretched taut. Safi hated those scars. She'd stared at the white pox a million times growing up, wrapped around a wine jug or pinching a whore's bottom. Those scars were all Safi really knew of her uncle, the only glimpse she'd had into his past. And whenever she saw them, she couldn't help but fear that this was the future awaiting her. An insatiable thirst for what could never be. Aaron wanted his honor. Safi wanted her freedom. Freedom from her title and her uncle and the frozen, frozen hostel halls. Freedom from the fear of hellbards and beheadings. Freedom from her witchery and the entire empire of Kartora.
"You have no idea what war is like," Aaron said,
his tone hazy, as if his mind also drifted across the old scars.
"Armies raising villages, fleets sinking ships, witches igniting you with a single thought. Everything you love gets taken away, Safiya, and slaughtered. But you will learn soon enough. In all too vivid a detail, you will learn. Unless you do as I ask. After tonight, you can leave forever."
A pause filled the room. Then Safi's jaw slackened. "Wait, I can leave?"
"Yes."
Aaron offered an almost sad grin, fidgeting once more with his necklace. When he spoke again, the first sparks of truth, of happy warmth, awakened in Safi's chest.
"After you play the role of the dancing, drinking Domna," he began, "and you do it for all of the empires to see, well, after that, you'll be entirely free to go."
Free to go. The words reverberated through the air like the final note in an explosive symphony. Safi swayed back. This was more than her mind could swallow, more than her witchery could swallow. Aaron's words quavered and burned with truth. "Why?" Safi began carefully, afraid the wrong word would erase everything her uncle had said. "Would you let me leave? I'm supposed to be Domna of the Hastral Lands."
"Not quite."
He raised a single arm over his head and leaned against the glass. Everything about his posture was strangely indulgent, and his necklace, now removed, hung between his fingers.
"Titles won't matter soon, Safiya. And let's face it, neither you nor I ever expected you to actually lead the estate. You aren't exactly cut out for leadership."
"And you are?" she bristled. "Why did I study my whole life if this was your plan all along? I could have just left."
"It wasn't my plan," he cut in,
shoulders tensing.
"But
things change when war is on the horizon.
Besides, do you regret all the tutoring and training you received?"
His head tipped to one side.
"Your encounter with the Gold Guildmaster almost ruined everything I have planned, but I've managed to salvage the evening. Now, all you have to do is act like a frivolous Domna for a single night, and then your duties will be done. Forever."
Safi sputtered a laugh.
"That's it? That's all you want from me? All you've ever wanted from me? Forgive me if I don't believe you."
He shrugged dismissively.
"You don't have to believe me. But what does your magic say?"
Safi's witchery hummed with truth, warm behind her ribs. Yet still she found it impossible to swallow this story. Everything she'd ever wanted was suddenly being handed to her. It seemed far, far too good to be true. Aaron arched a pale eyebrow, clearly amused by Safi's bewilderment.
"When the chimes toll midnight, Safiya,
the Bloodwitch will no longer be a problem.
Then you can do whatever you please and live out the same unambitious existence you've always enjoyed.
Although, he paused, gaze sharpening.
There was no sign of drunkenness now.
If you wanted to, Sophia, you could bend and shape the world. You have the training for it. I've seen to that.
Unfortunately, he spread his scarred hands, stretching the chain taut.
You seem to lack the initiative.
If I lack the initiative,
Safi whispered, the words tumbling out before she could stop them,
then it's because you made me this way.
Too true.
Aaron smiled down at her, a rueful thing that frizzed with honesty.
But don't hate me for that, Sophia. Love me.
His arms opened idly.
And dread me.
It's the Hustral way, after all.
Now, finish getting dressed. We leave at the next chime.
Without another word, Aaron stalked past Safi and left the room. Safi watched him go. She made herself watch his brisk gait and broad back.
Safi sank into the injustice for several blistering seconds. Unambitious. Lacking initiative. Perhaps that was true when it came to living in a frozen castle amidst a world of power-hungry nobility and ever-watchful hellbards, but not when it came to a life with Isolde.
Safi pulled out the Carowyn book once more and flipped it open. The piastra shone up at her, blooming like a rose at sunset. This page in particular was important, and Safi simply had to sort out why. She dragged her finger down the ranks and divisions of monks. Mercenary monk, teacher monk, guardian monk, artisanal monk. Her fingers paused on healer monk. It was one such monk who'd found Isolde when she'd fled her tribe. Isolde had gotten lost at a crossroads north of Vinyatsa City, and a kind healer monk had helped her find her way. And that old crossroads was beside the lighthouse that the girls now used.
Isolde must be planning to leave Vinyatsa City altogether and return to the usual hideout.
Safi dropped the book. Her head lolled back. She couldn't go there yet. She had to get through tonight first. She had to get this blood witch off her trail and her uncle firmly taken care of. Then, with no worry of pursuit, ever again, she could head north of the city and find her thread sister. Safi exhaled sharply, head lowering and body shifting toward the mirror. Aaron wanted a dutiful domna, did he? Well, Safi could give him that. Throughout her childhood, the Kartoran nobility had seen her as a quiet, embarrassed thing, cowering behind her uncle while her toes tapped and her legs bounced. But Safi wasn't that girl anymore, and the Hellbards had no power in this empire. So Safi puffed out her chest, pleased at how the gown emphasized her shoulders, how the sleeves stopped high enough to reveal her palms, striped with as many calluses as any soldier. Safi was proud of her hands, and she couldn't wait for the domes and domnas to stare at them with revulsion, for the nobility to feel her fingers, rough as sandstone when she danced with them. For one night, Safi could be Domna of Kartora. Hell, she would be a rutting empress if it got her back to Isolde, and away from the Blood Witch. After tonight, Safia von Hastral would be free.
8.
Isolde stared at the dark mane of her brindle mare, one hand on the reins and the other held high in a poor attempt to stem her wounds bleeding. The canal beside her glowed orange with the setting sun, and the stench of Vinyatsa City was finally starting to fade from her nostrils, as was the day's heat. Soon, Isolde would leave this damp marshland entirely and enter the wild meadows that surrounded her Nomatsi home. Mosquitoes would swarm her, and the horseflies would feast. The traffic flooding from the guard's eastern checkpoint had been thick enough for Izzult to slink out of the capital unseen. Then, once the roads had emptied of people, she'd hopped onto her new steed and urged the mare into a full gallop. The bleeding from the cut on her palm hadn't staunched, so she'd torn off the olive trim of her skirt and wrapped her hand. Each time the blood soaked through, she'd ripped off more cloth, bandaged the wound more tightly, and then held her hand even higher.
"Only one night,"
she told herself over and over, a refrain thundering in time to the horse's four-beat gallop, then the three-beat canter. Finally, 2 leagues from the city limits, when the mare was dark with sweat, Izzult had dropped to a 2-beat trot.
"One night, one night."
Beneath that percussive reminder pulsed a desperate hope that Izzult hadn't somehow endangered Safi by pointing her to the old lighthouse. Split-second plans weren't her strong point, and that's what the message to Habim had been. Haphazard. Rushed. Eventually, Izzult reached a telltale copse of alders and slowed the mare to a walk before sliding off the saddle. Her upper thighs seared. Her lower back groaned. She hadn't ridden in weeks, and not at such a speed in months. She could still feel her teeth rattling from the gallop, or maybe that was the buzz of the cicadas in the white thorns. Though it looked like Izzult followed nothing more than a game trail winding through the grass, she knew it for what it was. A Nomatsi road. She moved more slowly now, careful to read the Nomatsi markers as they came. A stick hammered into the dirt that looked almost accidental. It meant a claw-toothed bear trap at the next bend in the path. A cluster of wild morning glories on the left side of the path meant a fork in the road ahead. East would lead to a poison witch mist. West to the settlement. Following this path would get the blood witch off of Izzult's trail for good. Then, after a few hours within the settlement's thick walls, Izzult could set out once more to meet Safi. Although the Delmati Empire technically allowed Nomatsis to live as they pleased, so long as their caravans stayed at least 20 miles outside of any city, they were also declared animals. They had no legal protection, yet plenty of Delmati hatred to contend with. So, to say the Medenzis did not take kindly to outsiders was a vast understatement. As one of the only Nomatsi tribes to have settled down and stopped nomadic traveling, the Medenzis had found a safe niche here and clung to it. The walls were thick, the archers keen, and if the Blood Witch could somehow navigate this far, he would find a chest full of barbed arrows awaited him. Yet, just as the Medenzis fought to keep outsiders away, they also fought to keep their own people in. If you left the settlement, you were deemed other. And other was the one thing a Nomatsi never wanted to be. Not even Izzult. When the telltale oaks masking the edge of the settlement's walls finally appeared, black and menacing in the night's darkness, Izzult stopped. This was her last chance to run. She could turn around and spend the rest of her life without ever seeing the tribe again, though a short life that might be with the Blood Witch hunting her. The moon was rising east of Izzult, illuminating her for all to see. She'd wound up her braid and tied it beneath her headscarf. Nomatsi women kept their hair chin length. Izzult's fell halfway down her back. She needed to keep that hidden.
"Name!"
a voice called out in the guttural Nomatsi tongue. A hostile steel thread flickered at Izzult's left, along with the faint shape of archers in the trees. She lifted her hands submissively, hoping the bindings on her palm weren't too obvious.
"Izzult!" she shouted, Isolt that Mittensie.
Oak leaves rustled. Branches creaked. More threads shimmered and moved as God